This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Israeli disengagement from the Gaza Strip is scheduled to begin next week. However it develops, this will be a major story for Israelis and Palestinians. Today we focus on the debate within Israel, on politics, personalities, on peace, and on national identity. Later, as withdrawal proceeds, we'll discuss the impact for Palestinians. Jewish settlers in Gaza have known for months that they will have to leave their homes. Today, 1,700 families started to receive letters of notification and warning. Evacuate by August 17th or face physical removal. The controversy surrounding the pullout has engulfed much of Israeli society. On the surface, you can see divisions by color. Those in support of the pullout wear blue, those opposed, orange. Then there's an ongoing debate that many frame in terms of peace, relations with Palestinians, and respect for law, while others denounce what they regard as betrayal and retreat and cite a higher law. In a few minutes, we'll talk with a defiant settler and with a police official. We'll also hear from a supporter of the pullout plan and try to put this moment into wider political context. Later in the program, relatives wait for the return of the space shuttle Discovery is over, and we'll take a look back at the work of African-American media pioneer John H. Johnson. But first, withdrawal from Gaza. If you have questions about what's happening there and why, give us a call. What would you ask a settler intent on staying? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And we begin with Laura King. She's the Los Angeles Times bureau chief in Jerusalem and joins us from her home there. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You were in Gaza yesterday and today. Tell us what you saw.
Well, it's really two different stories on the Palestinian side and on the settler side of things. These are just universes that do not intersect at all. On the settler side, you're starting to see more of an acknowledgement that this withdrawal is going to happen, is indeed going to go ahead. And families are beginning to pack up and leave. It really is very different in different parts of the Gaza Strip, however. In some of the three small northern settlements, which are more secular than religious, people really are starting to leave in large numbers. One of them that we visited today is just about a ghost town at this point.
How forceful are those letters people started receiving today from the Israeli government?
Well, a lot of people did not receive the letters because they evaded delivery of them. Even at the main checkpoint going in, they were handing them out, and many settlers simply rolled up the window of the car and refused to accept them. But basically, the letter reiterates what has been known for weeks or even months at this point, that the date after which it will be illegal to be in the Gaza Strip is at midnight on Sunday. And so I think pretty much everyone is aware of that at this point.
Is there a fear that, some settlers have vowed that they will not be removed except by force?
Some have indeed. And I think what's probably of more concern to the army and to the police are some settler activists who have arrived from outside the Gaza Strip. They do not live there, but they are settlers from some of the more extreme settlements in the West Bank, and they have been making their way in and setting up tent cities. And they are among the ones that the authorities are expecting to put up the most physical resistance, even though, as I say, they are not actually living in Gaza.
How is this moment being framed in terms of Israeli history?
I think pretty much across the board, however people regard the decision favorably or negatively, it is seen as an historic moment. It just brings together so many strands of the Israeli national ethos, and it's a question of competing narratives. I think people who thought that the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza has been a mistake now feel vindicated, and those who feel that the settlement enterprise was a heroic movement are feeling very betrayed.
Mm-hmm. The anti-pullout side says Israel is getting little or nothing in exchange for its departure.
Well, I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. For one thing, I think Israel is getting international approval on a scale that it has not enjoyed for some time. I mean, I think particularly its great ally, the United States, has made it very clear that they do want this to go ahead, and that they see Mr. Sharon's agenda in all this as being one that the United States supports. So there is that benefit, but also, especially following on the death of Chairman Arafat late last year, a lot of people are feeling that this is a moment in which the two sides might be able to sit down and talk, which is something that just didn't happen during the whole Arafat era, and especially during the last nearly 5 years of extremely violent fighting. So there is a sense that because of a confluence of lots of factors, that this could really be a moment when the two sides could begin to deal with one another.
Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Right now we're speaking with Laura King of the Los Angeles Times in Jerusalem, and let's talk with Clydia. Am I pronouncing that right, in Raleigh, North Carolina?
No, darling, it's Clydia.
Clydia, excuse me. Go ahead.
Clydia.
Go ahead, please.
My question is there a, forgive me for not knowing this, is there a place that the settlers are being put in, lousy grammar, does the government have a plan, or do they have to make their own plan as to where they're going when they are removed?
Laura King, where are they being moved to?
Well, the settlers have lots and lots of relocation options, but the thing is, some of the most staunch opponents of the plan have refused to speak with the government and go over the various possibilities. There are a few settlements that are trying to move en masse and are going to another location in the southern part of the country, in the Negev. There's one rather large community that's being constructed just about 6 miles north of Gaza in a very similar kind of terrain. Between the compensation that is being offered if people want to rent temporarily and not decide right away what they're doing, and a permanent compensation that amounts to several hundred thousand dollars per family, those who are leaving, even though it's of course a big production for any family, they do have options, and they do have alternate housing available to them.
Clydia, thanks very much for the call, and I apologize for the mispronunciation.
That's quite all right.
Okay, appreciate it. Thanks very much. Finally, Laura King, I did want to ask you if police, are they anticipating, as you mentioned, there are demonstrations scheduled again next week, and settler allies, activists, who may be theatrical next week.
Well, the situation is so fluid, it really is changing from day to day, but I think in general that the tone of the demonstrations has shifted away somewhat from people actually believing that they can stop this from happening to people merely wanting to make their voices heard, and it is a democratic process after all. And the people who oppose this the most strongly really, really do feel that up until the very, very last moment they want to make their voices heard.
Laura King, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Laura King is a Los Angeles Times bureau chief in Jerusalem and joined us from her home there. We wanted to hear why some Israelis are planning not to leave their homes in Gaza. And with us now is Rachel Saperstein, joining us from Gush Katif. And that's within the Gaza Strip. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well.
Good.
You have, at least according to the Israeli government, less than a week to stay in your home. Are you planning to leave?
I am planning to stay here. My house is now filling up with guests. We will have at least 20 people in our home. We are being threatened that our water, our food supplies, and our phone, electricity, cell phones will be cut off. This will be a humanitarian disaster, but we are going to hold up over here, and we're not going to give up. And this is a problem, especially for a woman my age who's 64, and babies who are living here, and the hundreds and hundreds of visitors of all ages that are in all the schoolrooms, tents, shelters, any place that there is an open spot, youngsters and families and older women have just decided to give up their placid lives, their comfortable homes, and are sleeping on thin mattresses and sharing overheated rooms just to be here and to say no.
If this does go ahead, and every indication is that it will, how will Israel be different the day after this goes ahead than it was the day before?
The people here are in despair. They're just horrified that our democratic country has turned into a dictatorship of Ariel Sharon and his cohorts. We've seen our liberties taken away from us. We've seen people pulled off buses, bus drivers pulled off buses wanting to take protesters to the southern part of the country. We see, what can I tell you, terrible despair, especially in the young people, people who were raised, young kids who were raised with love of Israel, love of Zionism, love of the government, love of the army, and they're turned into youngsters whose beliefs are all being crushed. And the army, the wonderful army, their morale is crushed. Think of a young soldier who has to come in and pull out mommies and daddies and babies from their homes and drag them to buses at gunpoint. This is what Israel has turned into.
We have to take a short break. Can you stay with us for just a moment?
Yes.
Okay. Rachel Saperstein is our guest. She lives in the Gaza Strip. The government has issued instructions that all Jewish settlers who live there must leave their homes next week as Israel withdraws from the Gaza Strip. We'll continue talking about this controversy after we come back from a break. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Israeli settlers in the Gaza Strip are receiving final formal notice that it's time to leave. The military sent out letters yesterday to the Strip's 9,000 settlers informing them their presence in the area will become illegal on August 15th. Forcible removal would begin August 17th. That's next Wednesday. Today we're discussing the fault lines in Israeli society laid bare by the long-planned withdrawal from Gaza. To learn more about the political consequences for Israelis and Palestinians and see a detailed map of Gaza, you can go to our website at npr.org. And those of you who'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking right now with Rachel Saperstein, who lives in the Gaza Strip and has vowed not to leave, not willingly anyway. Let's get a caller on the line. And this is Deborah. Deborah calling from Baldwins. Am I pronouncing that right?
That's right. Baldwin, Kansas.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, my question, Rachel, is the following. Why would you and the other settlers who are refusing to leave want to risk the lives of children, soldiers, and also go against a religious right government that you helped elect for land that, unlike the West Bank, is not religiously important to Israel? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. Rachel Saperstein?
Yes. First of all, the land of Gaza belongs to the Jews. It is part of the tribe of Judah. There has always been a Jewish presence in Gaza. And in 1967, the Jews returned home. Many of our songs that we sing Friday night were written here in Gaza, written by the chief rabbi of Gaza. Remember Samson? He did all his heroics here in Gaza. Think of our father Abraham and Isaac coming to the area of Gerar. This is Gerar, and those who know their Bible will know what I'm talking about. This is where they dug their wells. And just as our headlines read today, when Father Isaac came here and he dug his wells, the land flourished. And then the Philistines came and said, oh, it's flourishing. It's ours. We want it. And instead of watching it grow and helping it grow, they poured sand. They poured sand into the wells. And then the land returned to desert. Then this is what the Jews have done today by their return to Gaza. And why are we here? Because this is our holy land. We have a small sliver of land here in the beautiful land of Israel, God's promised land to the Jewish people. And we do not want to give our land away to Hamas, to Al-Qaeda, to Hezbollah, and other terrorists who live here in Gaza and will begin to attack every single part of Israel with the weaponry brought in overland, not in tunnels, but overland from Egypt. This is what we are begging the American president. We're begging Condoleezza Rice. Don't allow this to happen. Mm. We're not going to be killing our children. Absolutely, just the opposite. The children will be killed if we leave. We are a buffer zone, and we have been living under bombardment, and we stayed here, and we lived here, and we showed the world what bravery is. People holding on to their land. We can't give it away. We can't just hand away the land of Israel. It belongs to the Jewish people. One little piece of land, and we're not permitted to hold on to it?
Rachel Saperstein, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Rachel Saperstein joined us by phone from her home in Gaza. Israeli police and military will be charged with removing settlers who, like Rachel Saperstein, may refuse to leave their homes. Joining us now to tell us about police preparation for disengagement is Israeli police spokesperson and superintendent Carla Oz. She's with us by phone from her home in Jerusalem. Thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Good evening.
As I'm sure comes to no surprise to you, settlers like Rachel Saperstein have plans to stay put in what they regard as their homes. How are you going to be able to handle that situation?
Well, the Israel police has been in preparation for 6 months for this mission. We've been undergoing exercises and practicing all kinds of scenarios, and we are prepared to face anything that we need to. This is a mission that we need to carry out.
There has been special training for this.
Yes, for the last 6 months we've been training arm in arm. We've been working with the IDF, with the Israeli Army.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been training in bases. Army bases have been turned into mock settlements so that they can practice evacuating homes. Yesterday I participated in a practice where people were evacuated from tall buildings, women, schools where there were many women involved, any kinds of special details that need to be addressed have hopefully been addressed by the people that will need to evacuate them.
Mm-hmm. There will, of course, be challenges to the police officers who will be charged with carrying out this task, and these will not be easy things to hear.
No, first of all, it's very important to understand that we're very aware of the right of the citizens, not only the settlers, but the citizens in Israel, to have their opinions made known. And it's a democratic country, and they have the right to protest, and we're here to protect them when they are protesting. And there is no winner or loser in this situation. The whole country is, you know, torn by this.
Mm.
But it was a decision made in a democratic process, and the police are here to carry out that mission.
I wonder if you've spoken with police personnel who feel conflicted about what they may be asked to do.
Well, first of all, for instance, today we received a message from our police commissioner who sent us all a message, and in it he said that he's very well aware that as citizens and people here in Israel were allowed to our own opinion, but certainly we're not allowed to have it be made public, and certainly it is not to affect us in our functioning as a police officer.
And nevertheless, there's a possibility at least that some police officers, some people in the army may decide to let their feelings be known and in effect, defect?
Well, if I can't speak for the Army, but it is known that in the police, if someone wants to refuse to do his function in the disengagement, he will be released from his position. So far, we haven't seen a large amount of police officers who are refusing to undertake this mission.
And numbers, obviously you're talking tactics, but this is going to be a very large operation, is it not?
It's a very, very large operation. We're talking just about 15,000 troops, which are made up of police and Army officers, who will be in the inner circle, which will be involved with actually evacuating the people from their homes. That is not taking into consideration the other police and Army personnel that will be involved in the rest of the country in other functions that relate to disengagement and just keeping the peace here in Israel for the rest of the country.
Police spokesperson Carla Oz, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
She joined us by phone from her home in Jerusalem. There are deep but recognizable divisions in Israel over the disengagement in Gaza. To learn more about the level of Israeli support for the pullout, we are joined now by Uri Dromi. He's International Outreach Director with the Israeli Democracy Institute, and he's with us now from the studios at the Jerusalem Post. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be with you.
Is it difficult for those who are in favor of this withdrawal to find themselves on the same side as Ariel Sharon, their longtime nemesis?
Yes, talk to me. I mean, to find myself supporting and praising Ariel Sharon, I have to pinch myself to believe that this happens. But the fact is that here is a man who made a U-turn, a big U-turn. He was the one who supported or was the greatest enthusiast and supporter of the settlements. He himself, as a minister in some governments, went out of his way to help them prosper. And now he turns to these people and say, sorry, guys, I made a mistake and we're out of Gaza. So for us, people who for a long time believed that Israel shouldn't be in Gaza, this is good news. There is a problem here, you know, because, for example, some of us know that Sharon's conduct, some people say it was not so democratic, you know, the way he brought about this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that, and I think the media, at least, which supports Sharon's move, tended to turn a blind eye to many of the things he did. So it's very delicate here. It's complicated by basically, yes, people in the center and the left who for years thought we should pull out of Gaza suddenly find their salvation in Sharon. And it exemplifies what we know in Israel, that in Israel only the right can carry out the policies of the left.
Tory reformers, Nixon in China, that sort of thing.
Right.
The majority of Israelis, according to opinion polls, support disengagement. Yet it appears that those who are opposed are more passionate in their opposition than those who are in favor are in favor of the pullout.
There's one way to show it, and you're right. You know, we are now divided as drivers, those who carry orange stripes to show their solidarity with the settlers, or blue stripes to show that they support the disengagement. And you see many more orange stripes, especially here in Jerusalem, my hometown. And this is because these people have a lot more to lose. And they are more organized and they are passionate. And by the way, they are ideological people, and I salute them for many of the things that they have done in the past. I think they are wrong, but still I cannot ignore the fact that these people put their money where their mouth is. They go and settle in God-forsaken areas and risk their lives because they believe in an ideal, they have a vision. So they are more, they have more resolve, and they are more organized. And you know, usually The others, the silent majority, are less active.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Joshua. Joshua calling us from Denver in Colorado.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, it's interesting he's saying the blue, those of us that had blue stripes, are, I just returned from Israel 5 days ago after being there for 2 years. And having blue stripes, no, I don't think anyone is in favor of, like, pulling people out of their homes and separating them from their communities. But so you're not going to, like, actively voice that, I don't think. I think you, but I think the you do want to say something about, you know, justice and peace and creating that. It's hard to actively voice pulling people out of their home. But in regards to the American Jewish experience, it seems that here in America, because you know, the way we perceive political issues, it's either you're for or against. And I think in Israel, my experience was that it was a lot more it wasn't so split, meaning you can be for disengagement, but you're not for pulling people out of their homes. And so it came...
Well, doesn't one necessarily possibly mean the other? If you're going to disengage, you may have to pull people out of their houses?
Exactly, but you can also... But that doesn't mean it doesn't come with pain and feeling like, oh... I certainly understand the plight of being a settler and having being part of a state that says... That for so long supported and gave economic cutbacks or economic incentives to live in the Shachim, in the territories, and to obviously it's very difficult that now the state is turning on them. But
yeah, we're talking about the Gaza withdrawal. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Uri Dromi, I was wondering if you had a response to Joshua's call.
Yes, I agree with him because let me give you an example. I just yesterday I spoke with a unit of soldiers and officers who were supposed to next week knock on doors of those settlers and tell them, guys, sorry, but your time is up. And the feeling there is there's a mixed feeling there. And obviously the troops going to obey orders because this is the way democracy operates. But they are they have loaded the feeling and the slogan there of the whole operation, so to speak, is we're going to do it with resolve but with empathy. And with sensitivity. So we're not facing enemies, we're not opponents, we're all of us in it together. The government has decided, the Knesset, our duly elected parliament has decided, the Supreme Court ratified it. So we're going to do it, but we're not happy about it. And maybe that explains why people are not so quick to boast with the blue stripes. Mm-hmm. You know, they're resigned to the fact that we're doing it, but it's difficult for all of us.
Joshua, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Uri Dromi, we just have a minute or so left with you, but I did want to ask, is this a moment in history? Is this a dividing line between a secular Israel that obeys the rule of law and what some would argue, a more Zionist Israel that obeys the rule of God?
Well, not Zionist, but religious Israel.
Religious Israel, Israel yes.
Because Zionism was initially a secular break away from traditional Judaism.
My mistake in characterization, yes.
No. We don't have time to elaborate on that.
Okay.
But there is a chance here or a threat here that it's going to be a big divide between people who believe that sovereignty lies in the people through the parliament and the government, and people who say that when it comes to crucial issues, authority lies elsewhere, that is in God. And it's pity for me, I saw the scenes last week when soldiers were and officers and the police officer were standing in front of the protesters, and the protesters picked especially on the guys who wore a skull cap, the yarmulke. I mean, the religious guy, and says, shame on you, you should resign, you're not Jewish, blah, blah. And These people are split between listening to the rabbi, their spiritual leaders, and their commanders. I think at the end of the day, people will obey orders, because if we don't respect democracy, we can't go through this together. But again, it's a big test for us all.
Uri Dromi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
Uri Dromi of the International Outreach Center with the Israel Democracy Institute. More after a break. This is NPR News. Now let's continue our conversation about the impending withdrawal from Gaza. The resignation of Finance Minister Benjamin Netanyahu prompts speculation that he may engage Prime Minister Sharon in a power struggle for leadership of the Likud bloc. Joining us now to discuss the politics of the Gaza withdrawal is Mark Heller. He's a principal research associate with the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies. He's with us now by phone from his home in Tel Aviv. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Let's go back just a little bit. Mr. Sharon was elected as the head of the Likud bloc, and, well, his coalition splintered over this issue.
That's right. He lost the coalition that he originally put together when the far-right party split off, and he had to bring in the Labor Party in order to keep a parliamentary majority.
Is that coalition with the labor opposition and elements of Likud, does anybody regard that as stable?
No, it's almost universally expected that sometime after the disengagement, or at least after the holidays in the fall, that labor will probably break away and there will be a general agreement to dissolve parliament and go to the polls.
Now, Benjamin Netanyahu, former prime minister, who's been in the coalition, well, he suddenly resigned at the last minute, saying he could not. You tell us what he had to say.
Well, the official explanation he gave at his press conference was that his conscience didn't allow him to stay around any longer. The only reason he claims he hadn't left before was because of the responsibility he felt as finance minister to carry through the economic reforms that he had been trying to initiate.
Now, this is a serious political matter. Netanyahu would be a formidable rival for Mr. Sharon, would he not?
I think he would be a very serious rival for Sharon within, in terms of getting the nomination of his own party. In fact, the latest public opinion poll that was published this evening of Likud party members showed Netanyahu with a substantial lead. But, of course, things are always more complicated than they seem. There is also, working in Sharon's favor, the knowledge among Likud people that Sharon is far more appealing to the general electorate and is therefore likely to bring them better results in the election than overall results than Netanyahu would.
So electability, a word we might
electability
remember.
Electability is an important consideration, yes.
Yes, indeed. Let's get a listener on the line. This is Karen. Karen calling us from Philadelphia.
Hi. I just returned from spending a month in Israel, and I had 2 points that I wanted to make based on my observations from my time there.
Mm-hmm.
One is that the settler movement seems to have really gathered the support of those who feel disenfranchised by Israeli society. So the poor, the Mizrahi population, the people who are from Eastern or Asian or African backgrounds, the religious, the young all of those who feel that they don't have the kind of voice in society have really gathered around this issue. I don't know that this is really their issue,
mm-hmm.
but some kind of either the movement itself or some kind of forces of publicity, something has happened to make this a very powerful movement.
Let's get a comment from Mark Heller. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with the entire characterization. I think it's definitely true that the opposition to the disengagement is much stronger among the religious than it is among the less observant population. But I'm not sure that there's a strong correlation on ethnic, so-called ethnic or class lines. By and large, there is a consistent and strong majority of the overall public in favor of this. The disenfranchised that were referred to by the last caller are the traditional main constituency of Likud.
I see.
But they are also the ones who are most alienated and adversely affected by the economic reforms that Netanyahu has been pushing, and the angriest at him for the policies that he pursued as finance minister. And so it's a much more complicated situation than that. I don't think it's altogether accurate to depict opposition to disengagement as a social protest movement.
Karen?
Well, all I know is that as I walked through the various neighborhoods in Jerusalem, and as I traveled through the country talking with people and looking at where the orange ribbons were,
mm-hmm.
you know, up north and through, you know, I saw much more moderate opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And as I traveled through the poor and the Mizrahi neighborhoods of Jerusalem, I saw much more support of the settler movements.
Okay.
The other point that I wanted to make had to do with the issue of compensation.
Issue of? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Compensation, she said.
Oh, yes, okay.
many of the people who became settlers did so not, although some out of religious conviction, many out of economic for the sake of economic opportunity. And I wanted to point out to the listening audience that housing in Israel, particularly in the major urban areas, is very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was struck by your first reporter who quoted a compensation figure somewhere in the area of several hundred thousand dollars. And I know that in my neighborhood in Jerusalem, new apartments are being built and are being sold for $500,000 to $750,000. So to say
just to put that in financial context,
$100,000 really is not only not compensation; it's kind of a slap in the face to somebody. And so,
okay, Karen,
I can sympathize on that level.
Okay, Karen, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate the point. And Mark Heller, before we let you go, would it be fair to say that this is going to be a defining issue, the withdrawal from Gaza, in Israeli politics for at least the next period of time?
Well, I think it has important potential ramifications. First of all, for the entrenchment of the rule of law. Secondly, it's quite possibly going to lead to some kind of ideological reassessment among the those who have opposed the disengagement up until now. It may even prompt some kind of reconfiguration of the whole party system. And so it does have some very serious longer-term implications.
Mark Heller, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mark Heller, Principal Research Associate with the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies, with us by phone from his home in Israel.